Welcome to Therapeutic Perspective. My name is Sarah Dynan, and I will be your host. Each episode, our goal is to educate clinicians on current issues presented in society and feature specialists that can help us to navigate these issues. As a licensed professional counselor in private practice in Northeast Pennsylvania with over a decade in the field, I am always wanting to learn more to better serve my clients. Especially as things in society evolve and change, I believe we need better access to current information. Therapeutic Perspective is a continuing education provider. Hey, welcome to Therapeutic Perspective. I am your host, Sarah Dynan. Today, we are here with Dr. Alicia Reiser. Alicia holds a doctorate in occupational therapy and is a certified brain injury specialist. She is going to talk to us about the impact traumatic brain injuries, or TBIs, have on mental health and give us an understanding into why this is so. Alicia helps teens and adults with neurological conditions think, move, and perform everyday tasks to lead to a more fulfilling life, even if they didn't know they needed occupational therapy. Over the last 20 years, Alicia has worked at all major rehab hospitals and networks in Lehigh Valley, Pennsylvania, focusing predominantly on concussions over the last 10 years. She is currently the owner of a Rise Above Occupational Therapy services located in town in Pennsylvania, in which she provides outpatient occupational therapy services to the ortho and neurological populations. And I think it's so important that we have Alicia on here so that we can kind of combine both worlds of occupational therapy and mental health so that we can better understand and better serve our clients who may be suffering from a TBI. So without further delay, welcome to the show, Alicia.
Thank you for having me.
We are so excited to talk to you. And we were able to connect just a couple weeks ago. And to be honest, we here at Therapeutic Perspective, we haven't thought and even thought about doing a show on brain injury and concussions. And I am not very well versed in the impact that such can have on mental health. So this is all relatively new information for me, and I am excited to educate our listeners who also might not have any education or knowledge in this. I think this is going to be super helpful and informative podcast. So to start, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what led you to where you are now?
Sure. I'm excited to be here too. I think it's a great interprofessional collaboration that we can share a lot of our sessions, our talking sessions. And so it leads to a great connection for us to refer to you guys and then you guys to refer back to occupational therapy. I think it's super exciting that we're having this conversation today. So again, I'm super excited to be here. Like you said, I just celebrated my 20th year as an occupational therapy provider, as an OT. I initially started treating the neurological population, so stroke, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis. And about 10 years in was when they really started realizing that brain rest was not the true course for traumatic brain injury, but that actual activity and doing rehab for concussions and the like was more along the lines of what was most beneficial. That's when we started to get more concussions in the clinic. And so I had done my research on things that we could do to help them because it is a different kind of treatment strategy than with strokes and Parkinson disease and that sort of thing. In the meantime, I wound up getting my own concussion. So I totally was able to understand the things that our clients were going through in terms of mood and just frustration and the headaches that were going on and all of that sort of thing. And I also realized that there was a huge connection between concussion and issues that can happen visually and sensory wise. And so that really relates to OT in our field and what we kind of look at. At that time, I had decided to go back for my clinical doctorate in vision remediation and really connected that concussion and that vision piece that we had been missing and that I was unable to find for us to refer our clients to. So I really wanted to develop a more holistic approach to concussion care within the area that we're in here in Pennsylvania, because I felt like a lot of us were treating the piece of the person. We weren't really treating the whole person. So we were treating either the headaches, or we were treating the balance issues in PT, or we were treating the psychosocial stuff by talking therapy, but we weren't really putting it all together into one clear package. So that's really what my goal was when I opened up my private practice 4 years ago. So in the meantime, I've become a certified brain injury specialist, certified in interactive metronome, which looks a lot at auditory processing kinds of things. I'm interoception trained clinician. I'm a certified ADHD rehab provider, which a lot of concussion deficits are very executive function related in terms of cognition. And so we use a lot of polyvagal techniques just for that fight or flight response that happens a lot with concussion. And I'm also in the middle of getting a certification as a complete concussion management clinician. So just concussion is my thing.
It is. It is. Like, you have a whole breadth of different interventions that you do, and something that, you know, resonated with me. It's more than brain rest. You know, I don't think you'd be seeking out all these certifications if it was exclusively brain rest that you're doing for concussion patients, but it sounds like it's so many different interventions that you can use and what you use in your practice.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Can we start too? Can we, for our listeners who are not familiar with concussions and TBIs, can you tell us what constitutes a TBI or concussion? Like, what's the difference there?
Sure. So a traumatic brain injury is really just, here's the official diagnosis or definition.
Okay.
It's really any bump, jolt, or blow to the head, face, or neck. So it doesn't just have to be a hit in the head. It can be a whiplash injury that's induced by a biomechanical force or penetration. So it can be like a gunshot wound or a stabbing or that sort of thing that results in a rapid onset of neurological symptoms that happen. And then that impacts how the brain then is functioning. So in 2019, the CDC said that there were 61,000 deaths as a result of traumatic brain injury. So that kind of equates to 166 traumatic brain injuries a day that are resulting in death, not just, you know, surviving with a traumatic brain injury. And of course, those are also reported ones. There are also unreported ones as well. So there are three categories of a traumatic brain injury. So there's a mild traumatic brain injury, and that is what constitutes a concussion. So with a concussion, you have shearing and stretching of the axon that happens typically between the white and gray matter within the brain. So there's a whole neurological cascade that happens that we can talk about later that actually will help trigger those mental health issues that are that occur. But it's really just that stretching of the axon. There's no anatomical structural difference that you'll see on imaging. That's why it's considered a mild traumatic brain injury versus a more moderate or severe. There may or may not be a loss of consciousness. So I know back in the day that also used to be an indicator of what kind of traumatic brain injury you had, pending how long you were knocked out for or that sort of thing. So with a mild case, it's really still not mild. It's just considered that because of the loss of consciousness and the Glasgow coma scale that they use to rate your symptoms or your level of alertness when you have that traumatic brain injury. The moderate and severe ones have a lower Glasgow coma scale, so your level of alertness is less, and also you've been maybe having a longer loss of consciousness. You've also maybe have a little bit more of that post-traumatic amnesia, where you don't necessarily have that with a mild traumatic brain injury.
And so even what I'm hearing you saying is, even though it's mild, it's not something that should be treated mildly. Is that accurate?
Correct. It has a huge impact on, and this is why OT is so important, on everything that we do in terms of occupation and daily function. So a lot of the symptoms then, even just with a concussion, that manifest themselves are you have headaches that can range from, you know, very mild to debilitating. And it's definitely different than a migraine type of headache, because we do have a lot of patients that, you know, they're like, this is a different kind of headache than my typical migraine headache. you know, it impacts our balance. It impacts our vision. So a lot of times people are like, I have what's called more visual snow. So they get more floaters, or they get double vision or motion sensitivity where they didn't have that before. And so all of that is impacting their day-to-day life and their function. And then they're kind of like, no one told me, is this normal? Why is this happening now? So they get that, you know, that increased angst again, that kind of manifests itself in ways of anxiety and that sort of thing. There's a lot of cognitive pieces that can happen. Hypersensitivities to noise and to light. So then what people tend to do, because they don't want to go out in public, is then they tend to socially isolate. So now you've got someone who's, you know, symptomatic from the concussion, but doesn't want to go out into, you know, don't want to go out to eat, or they can't go to their kids' sporting events just because the lighting and the noise of that impacts their symptoms. And so they're trying to manage that. And then it becomes almost like a control issue where they're trying to figure out, where in my environment can I be where I'm symptom free, or at least not triggered by that. So there's a psychosocial aspect too of their loss of role. Because they are no longer, you know, like I mentioned, the parent that can go to the games or help their kids with homework, because now screen time is horrible because of the backlighting of the screen, or they're thinking and trying to use those executive functioning working memory things. I can't help my, you know, sixth grader with his math homework and his algebra now because I can't figure out how to sequence that. You know, you can't go out on a date night with your spouse. You can't go to work. And I think that's the biggest thing too, is that you have to convince, it's an invisible disease. It's one of those two that is definitely an invisible impact on one's performance, because people will see you out and about, but then they don't realize, like, for that 5 minutes that you were at the grocery store running in just so that you could get bread and milk, resulted in, you know, a 3-hour migraine, and then you went home and you vomited. Do you know what I mean? So it's definitely one of those things that you look like you're okay. You may look like maybe you have a headache, but, you know, there's definitely things that are impaired with that sort of thing. So
yeah. And like, as I hear you talking, I'm understanding how these all can lead to some really heavy mental health disorders. Like you're talking about isolation, and which can lead to depression. I could see somebody having stress on their relationship with their partner because they're not able to do those activities that kind of help build connection and the relationship. Even strain on parent-child relationships if that parent isn't able to attend some of those like sporting events or events at a school, or help them with their homework, or kind of be as present as they want to be as a parent because of the symptoms of the TBI. So I'm already starting to hear some of that like mental health side effects that come into play. Would you say that it's most like 100% if you have a TBI, you're going to have some mental health side effects to it?
I think at some point along the way, there's going to be something that happens. I tell a lot of our patients, especially because of that loss of role, that you kind of go through the 5 stages of grief. For sure, because you first have, you know, that that denial kind of aspect of it, like, no, this isn't really happening to me. Then you kind of go into that anger, especially if it's a result of like a motor vehicle accident, where this was not your fault that you got a concussion, right? I hear all the time, I wasn't the one who was texting yet. I'm the one sitting here, you know, who can't go to work, who can't pay my bills, who can't get the therapy I need because now my workers' comp is questioning whether I'm legitimate or not. So there's so many added stressors, you know, on the financial end and on, you know, who believes me, who doesn't. You know, people are always like, you know, there is a lot of people who still believe that concussion should be healed within 10 to 14 days. So if you go by that theory, these people who are, quote, malingering and are like a year out, like people don't understand why they're still symptomatic. So there's all of that psychosocial piece on top of the actual, you know, physiological things that are happening in terms of neurotransmitters that aren't being released that impact the mental health aspect of day-to-day life, really.
Yeah. Which that leads me to that question. So we've talked about some of the psychosocial pieces and how that relates to mental health, but what actually happens to the brain during a traumatic brain injury? You're kind of hinting at something going on neurologically. Can you explain this to clinicians?
So there's what's called a psychological or a physiological, cascade that occurs, and it actually occurs within the first 6 microseconds of the injury that happens. So what happens in, especially a concussion, if you're in a car accident or if you're playing sports or if you're doing a slip and fall kind of thing, especially for our geriatrics, that's one of the leading causes for traumatic brain injury and concussion. But what happens is that axon stretches from the force of the injury. And then what happens is the calcium leaks out of that axon. The neuron depolarizes, causing an action potential. That action potential releases a lot of glutamate and opens the calcium channels within the cell. And so now there's this influx of calcium within the cell, which binds to the mitochondria. That then prevents ATP production. No ATP is being produced. There's no energy. There's no active transport then to get the extra calcium out of the cell. And so now you're stuck in this cycle until all of that normalizes again. So because of that depolarization of the neuron in the cell and all of the chemicals that are being released, research is showing that there's definitely an impact on the blood-brain barrier. So it actually causes almost like a leaky brain. So there's studies that have shown cerebral spinal fluid then not where it should be, but actually in the brain and in the blood vessels rather than just in the brain and such where it should be. So then this causes an inflammatory response, which then impacts dopamine production. And so we know that dopamine then has an impact on mood and attention, on alertness, on sleep, motivation, working memory, all of those kinds of things. In addition to that, it can also cause an autonomic dysregulation, impacting that connection between the gut and the brain. So now we've got that gut-brain access that's impaired. Research is starting to show that that gut biome changes after a TBI pretty much within the first 72 hours. So now there's a loss of serotonin production. So now that's also impacting mood, that autonomic nervous system with the vagus nerve and all of that sort of thing, impacting anxiety and sleep. There's an impact on the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis. So that impacts norepinephrine production. And so memory, attention, alertness, mood, concentration, sleep, again, is all impacted by those neurotransmitters that are lacking or are at least in an imbalanced state. And then sleep. You know, if you're not getting any of those neurotransmitters, you're going to have a sleep disturbance in that sleep-wake cycle. Sleep deprivation, as we all know, impacts mood, emotional regulation, alertness, attention, goal-directed behaviors. This is sounding a lot like executive functioning kinds of things that are happening in our brain. Reaction time, memory recall. It heightens our pain response. So now we're in pain. So that's kind of causing a more, possibility of looking for addictive type kinds of strategies for coping mechanisms, right? It also creates an oxidative stress state in the gut if you're not having good sleep. So it's not necessarily a traumatic brain injury just to the brain. Again, is a whole body response of what is happening when you have just, and it can be a simple just bump to the head.
Yeah. So it's so much, like you're saying, it can affect your sleep. It affects the ability for serotonin, dopamine to be produced. It affects our gut. It affects so much of us. And I think that's so much of what we're not maybe recognizing and what maybe other people see and discount when they hear that you've had a TBI or just a bump to the head. They don't think about the overall impact that this has on the person. What kind of mental health symptoms would you see? I definitely hear depression, anxiety. Could you see some serious changes like to mood that would be diagnosable? It might present as bipolar disorder. Like what kind of things do you see in, that are indicative of mental health?
Sure. So it's definitely going to impact mood and behavior and personality, right? A lot of times things are happening in that frontal lobe too. So that response inhibition. So they may be acting out. There may be more of an aggressive behavior. So those sorts of things where they're not really, they're not themselves. They've almost had like a little bit of a personality change. And that's definitely more for the more severe traumatic brain injuries. But look what's happening. If you look at the chronic traumatic encephalopathy that's occurring a lot in football players and in boxers and in MMA fighters, there's that buildup of that tau protein. And it's typically in between the white and the gray matter there in the corpus callosum. So in those areas as well. And so that is impacting these aggressive behaviors. You're reading about these stories where people are being arrested or, you know, they're suicidal because they don't know how to cope. They don't know what's going on. They're not educated on these things that can happen and why it's happening. There is a ton more research that needs to be done in these areas. So it's all, we're on a great, road to, or a pathway to figuring out what's happening with the brain, but we are still in the infant, you know, stages of what is really happening and what are the long-term effects of these injuries. There's a lot of research now that's coming out that's saying, you know, is it because, you know, do concussions build on each other, or is it truly that we're not recovered from the first concussion? We're sending these kids back to return to play, and then they're getting another concussion before they're truly healed on a physiological state. They may be not having symptoms, but their brain isn't truly fully healed because their levels of some of these chemicals aren't back to normal. And so now we're backing them down again. So it's going to present as those chronic pain, substance abuse, possible kinds of issues that you're going to have with mental health. It may look like ADHD and all of these things too. If you have a premorbid condition, our brain is lazy. It doesn't like to do a whole lot of work. It wants to be efficient. It wants to work smarter, not harder. And so if you are already compensating for an executive dysfunction disorder, or if you're already compensating for a depressed mood or, you know, anxiety that's happening, it's a concussion or a traumatic brain injury is only going to impact that. And it's just going to make it harder for you to use those coping strategies that you've possibly built up or that you're lacking just in general.
So what you're saying is if prior to the TBI, you already had some underlying neurological or mental health conditions, the TBI would exacerbate those issues.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just because you're already trying to, you know, be functional in day-to-day, you know, living. And now you've got your issues that are already there. Plus now you might have, based on the kind of concussion, if you're having more of a cervicogenic one, which is, you know, basically creating pain at your neck, you'll have neck pain radiating up into your head, causing those headaches. So now you've got this pain that you didn't have before. So you really can't use those strategies that you were kind of really working hard for prior, because the pain is so much. You're at a 9 out of 10 headache. Like, you can't concentrate and you can't use those things that were kind of automatic before, but you still had to work at.
Yeah. And I think that's something I really want to highlight for clinicians who are listening, is sometimes when we're meeting with a client, we will go back and say, okay, so previously, what was successful for you? And so previously, we might be looking like pre-traumatic brain injury, when those strategies are not necessarily going to be as effective as they were prior. They're not going to be effective now because of the traumatic brain injury. So I'm noticing a lot of differences in our approaches that us clinicians need to tend to when we're working with an individual with a TBI. What other differences for mental health clinicians that we might see with an individual who's got a TBI versus somebody without one? What are some special things we need to tend to as clinicians working with individuals with TBIs?
I mean, I think a lot of the strategies that you do use are definitely beneficial, right? You want, it's very similar to, it's a sudden event, right, that just happened. They're not who they were 5 minutes before the car accident or 5 minutes before the fall or that sort of thing. So it is similar, like if you're treating someone for depression due to the death of a loved one that was maybe sudden, or a sudden divorce, or that sort of thing. So you're going to use some of those same strategies for sure in your therapeutic use of self, you know, with your client. Remember too that their processing of strategies might be a little bit slower. A lot of times with traumatic brain injury, the orthopedic issue is the main primary thing that's treated first, and then all of this concussion comes down possibly even a year later, that they're kind of recognizing that, you know what, I think I had a concussion on top of, you know, the fractured leg or the herniation of my neck and those sorts of things. And so I think, too, validating those feelings and acknowledging that loss of self is super important because of that role change that has happened. But I think the biggest difference is just educating them that these symptoms are normal. They're not normal for you, but they're normal for the condition. So many times we'll start, even in my evaluation, they're like, I feel crazy saying this, but like this happens. Is that normal? And people just aren't being given that education piece. Like, you're going to have that visual snow. You're going to see words on a page move, jump, swim, or float. And you look like you're in a fun house. I have people tell me, you know, I'm driving. Maybe I shouldn't be driving, but like, I see these things. I can't, you know, they're coming at me, or they looked a little warped and my depth perception is off. Like, is that normal? And so that's always our first piece of our evaluation too, is just being like, yes, that's normal for that to happen. It's not normal, but it's normal for you to happen after a concussion. I think the other thing you have to consider too, is that the physiologic piece with the neurotransmitters, it can improve. So when you're dealing more with, you know, an ADHD or a major depressive episode or that sort of thing, that usually is helped by medicine, right? Because you're giving them either a stimulant or that sort of thing, you know, medication to help with the neurotransmitter that's lacking. But after a concussion, they could and should be getting back to that normalized level. So their depression then is going to ebb and flow with that as well. And then hopefully once they're fully recovered, then they won't have the mood part, you know, after that. But for some people, there are some long-term effects and they do stay. So those are all things that you have to consider. It's not... And I don't want to say treating someone with depression or anxiety is cut and dry, but with a concussion, it's more dynamic and it changes more than someone who just has, I don't want to say a typical mental health.
No, but I get what you're saying. You know, for the sake of the show, it's like what we're accustomed seeing in mental health, depression and anxiety, but with TBI, it's more dynamic. And I hear what you're saying with the medication. There are some exceptions where individuals have long-term effects from their TBI and could be on medication long-term, but you could potentially see somebody just needing that medication short-term.
Absolutely.
And that include like a stimulant, like an ADHD medication that's purely being used because of the TBI and the side effects that they're having? Is that common?
I don't really see a whole lot of people being put on a stimulant to address the executive functioning disorder. But that being said, we did have a client who was prior to the accident, did have ADHD. He was off his meds because he felt like he was regulating and he was doing really, really well. Had a high stress job. Therefore, once he had the executive functioning issues from the concussion return, I had said to him, I was like, you might want to talk to your practitioner and your provider to see if maybe you want to go back on your stimulant medication, just to kind of see if that would be helpful for you. And it did wind up being very helpful for him. And then he was able again to gradually wean himself off once he felt kind of regulated again. But it got him, as you said, it got him over that hump so that he could kind of deal with emotionally what he was going through, and then getting him through his day-to-day job as well so that he could attend, you know, a little bit better than he had been.
I getcha. One of the things that you were saying is that the, you know, orthopedic part comes first. Like when somebody has an injury, like that's like the primary focus. And it might be like a year later that says, hey, somebody says, I think I had a traumatic brain injury when I, you know, had that accident, when I broke my leg, when something happened. So as us as clinicians, I'm picturing this person coming to therapy, talking about this sudden change, what kind of referral would we give if we're talking with the patient and they also talk about these changes occurring right around the time that they had this accident? Where do you recommend that we send our patients to?
I think and this is one of the things that I do too, on evaluation is I typically say, like, get a good history from them just of prior events. I usually say, so how many concussions have you had? And sometimes, well, I had the accident, you know, the car accident when I was 16. And then I played, especially if folks are over 40, because concussions weren't addressed typically back, you know, at that time. It was kind of like, shake it off. Yeah, go back in the game. And so a lot of our 40 and up clients that we have, they're like, well, I was diagnosed with one concussion, but I probably had 15. It's crazy when I hear a lot of football players tell me, I guess there was this drill that they used to do where they would send the big guy and the little guy into the middle of the circle and they'd tackle each other and then they'd kind of see who would win. And then they'd give smelling salts and be like, "Woo, you did it," you know, and that just like shocks me. But those are stories that I hear. Yeah. So I think one, getting a good history of, you know, do you have a history of concussion, whether it be diagnosed or undiagnosed. And a lot of people are like, oh, well, I fell off my bike when I was 5 and I had a headache for like 3 weeks. And I'm like, yeah, that was probably one. Yeah. Just so that they can have an understanding of, you know, that they probably do have a concussion. And then once you kind of have established that that might be where you're headed, hopefully you can send them to their primary care, and their primary care is well-versed on, you know, what to do or where to send them then for additional treatment for concussion. So it's good to know too, the signs and symptoms of that can be impacting them. So, and they're similar, here we go, to depression and anxiety, addictive behavior. So if you're having dizziness, if you're having nausea, if you're having headaches, if you're having visual disturbances, blurred double vision, that sort of thing, all of those things can be depression, anxiety related, but they can also be concussion related. So there's a lot of differential diagnosing kind of going on there. But if you're getting that vibe that something's going on, especially if they're a victim of domestic abuse or those sorts of things, you know, it's very, very possible that they've had a concussion. If you're fortunate enough to have in your area a concussion center or a clinic that actually, you know, specializes in concussion, that's definitely a place you want to send them, because then that provider can say, well, maybe you need some PT for the balance or for the headaches, or maybe you need to see a physiatrist and you need some trigger point injections, or maybe you need to go see OT or speech to work on some of the cognitive issues. Maybe you need to see neurooptometry so that they can address some of that double vision, blurry vision that you're having. You know, a lot of people don't understand how much vision impacts these folks with concussion. So if they're falling off the line, if there is that depth perception issue, you know, all of those things that impact function, 90% of our sensory information comes through our vision. So if anything is off there because of the concussion and the cranial nerves that can be impacted by that injury, you know, all of that kind of can impact their day-to-day living and how they're functioning.
Yeah. And so I'm kind of getting what you're saying, like, as we're talking with clients and we have our intake where our information gathering, getting the whole health history, us as clinicians need to kind of hit on, like, you know, a conversation about brain injury in some capacity and a whole, you know, a bit of a history with it. Have you ever had a concussion? Have you ever had a traumatic brain injury diagnosed or undiagnosed, like, just so that we can have a full understanding to make sure that we're not just exclusively treating the mental health symptoms, but making sure that we give them the proper referral so they're treating the whole problem. And we're not just exclusively tending to the mental health piece of it.
Absolutely. Because the more players that are involved in the care, then of course, you know, the better outcome it is for the person who's having these symptoms, whether they be truly only mental health related, or is it as a side effect from the TBI?
Is there, you know, especially in mental health, there's sometimes this fear of having a diagnosis, right? So people sometimes will avoid using insurance because they don't want any record of having a mental health diagnosis. Do you see that at all? Like, is there fear with having being diagnosed and seen by a doctor and having that concussion diagnosis? What kind of, do you see that or hear that at all?
I think it's almost quite the opposite. There is so much relief when they finally get to us and we acknowledge and validate that these things, I think most importantly, can be fixed or at least improved upon. I think there's more of that relief, like finally someone gets it and is understanding and is hearing me, versus it's a concussion, it can, you know, be fixed in 7 to 10 days, or just get over it. it's all in your head, because we've had people come to us and we've had, you know, medical providers tell them that too. It's all in your head. It's not, it's post-traumatic stress disorder, which is another thing I forgot to mention that can definitely, you know, come up along with this, especially if it's a motor vehicle accident again, or if there's, an abusive relationship issue again. You know, there's all of that trauma that happens that they can't, you know, if they had a dump truck in front of them and they see another dump truck barreling down on them and not paying attention, and now they're crushed between those two vehicles, like, that's a little frightening and probably doesn't want to make you want to drive again. So, but you have to get back in there and you have to get back on that horse and you have to drive. So all of those things can definitely be impacted. So I think we do, a lot of our sessions turn into talking therapy, and that's when we're kind of like, maybe you should see, you know, someone who's definitely more well-versed in this than we are, because you definitely need that talking piece to kind of process everything that's going on, and then we can deal on the other aspects of it. But I really think it's just a lot of that, that listening and validating and being like, okay, I got this kind of aspect of it versus just, get over it and you'll be fine in a week.
Yeah. And it gives them a direct course of treatment. And what I hear you saying a lot is sometimes there's this presumption that 7 to 10 days and you're good. Is there, I don't know if you can give us this or if there's so much variability in it, but what would be the average time to recover from a TBI?
Again, yeah, it, I always tell my patients when they ask to, I'm like, my crystal ball is broken on this one. But, you know, research initially has shown that in 7 to 10 days, symptoms should go away. But like I had alluded to before, just because symptoms have gone away doesn't mean physiologically your brain has restored all of those chemical reactions and that glutamate and has gone back to their basic level. So you could still be in that injured inflammatory phase, even though your symptoms have resolved. So typically, if at 14 days symptoms are gone, it still takes up to day 30 for you to be back up to those baseline levels. And that's based on information that we've developed from, you know, animal trials and that sort of thing. Because that's one of the things too with concussion. It's hard to study, you know, before postmortem kind of studies and looking at the brain and that sort of thing. So, good news is you're healed and, you know, that 7 to 10 day window. Other than that, it becomes more of a post-concussion syndrome where you're having symptoms for longer periods of time. And based on the treatment that they've gotten, if the visual aspect has been, you know, not attended to for over a year because no one's really thought to look at that, depending on what kind of providers you're going to. If you haven't seen a neurooptometrist, you know, it could be two and a half years where you're still having these issues. And then all you needed was a prism pair of glasses and a little bit of vision therapy. And now your headaches are less. And now, you know, your mood is better because you're not seeing double, you're not having headaches all the time, and you can actually go to work and you can perform your roles and that sort of thing. So, that's why it's so, so important to kind of have that holistic aspect of how to treat these guys, because, it's just so impactful on who they are as people.
Do you see that if people who don't get evaluated right away and who aren't seen by a provider who, gives them the proper resources and information for recovery, is it something where, oh, I've had that this injury happened 2 years ago and I've been having these symptoms for 2 years, does that make it harder for the person to recover, or, you know, because there's that buildup of time, or can they still recover efficiently?
So we tell a lot of people, especially because we are specialists at our practice, we work alongside optometry a lot. So we are doing some vision remediation in addition to the cognitive piece and the return to work and the return to learn. We tell people a lot, like, you've developed now compensatory strategies. So the longer you are status post that injury, you know, you've developed strategies. So you may not know it, but you're avoiding certain things, or you just think it's normal to leave a party after half an hour, take a 10 minute break and then come back in versus staying the whole 2 hours for the party. You know, you start to develop these strategies, like I said, and avoid behaviors. So being OTs, we kind of will put you into those situations and kind of pull you out gradually. So sometimes we will make symptoms worse, but we're reestablishing those neural connections and reestablishing those pathways so that you can do it like you should be able to do it, or so that you're functional in doing it for those things that you've been avoiding. So does it take a little bit longer? Sometimes, because you have to break those compensatory things that they were working on. It doesn't mean they can't use them to be functional. It's just if, you know, to develop new neuronal pathways, then sometimes it does take a little bit longer.
A little bit longer. And what I'm hearing you too, do you do exposure therapy for patients?
So it's not necessarily exposure therapy. Okay. I think probably how you're thinking. We may use a different word. Sometimes it's more of like a habituation kind of thing. So we'll tell people, like, you can go to the party, but always have an out. Do you know what I mean? Because you're going to, or go to the basketball game if it's kiddos, you know, be with your friends, but always have, like, you're going to become symptomatic at some point. So you need to kind of strategize there. So a lot of OTs will work on that functional transition board to table, because a lot of times in school, that's the biggest thing that's triggering kids to get a headache, when they're looking from taking notes to looking at the class, to looking at the chalkboard or the whiteboard and that sort of thing. So that crossing of their eyes back and forth, near and far, is going to be a trigger for them. So we'll kind of try and do that mass practice. It's a theory that we use in neuro rehab. Just if you do it over and over again, it's almost like a muscle memory, and that will help them. So it is kind of the same thing in terms of exposing them to, especially if they're hypersensitive to noise, we'll tell people to start listening to classical music that doesn't have any words. Then we'll start to say, you know, now, listen to more of a podcast kind of conversation. Then you can gradually increase yourself to music with words, because it's just the layering of the complexity of the listening and the processing of information. So we will kind of grade them that way. So I guess it's, in a way, it's a little bit of an exposure therapy, but it's more of like a gradual increase so that their tolerance gets better.
Because one of the things I could see what happens in the mental health community, as clinicians, if we have a patient and we don't do that, like, history and to uncover if they've had any traumatic brain injuries, I could have a client who I might see, oh, they have social anxiety and they don't want to go to a party. So I might encourage, we would call them exposure therapy techniques. Let's try going to the party for 30 minutes. So I just kind of want to reiterate for clinicians, this is like another reason why we really need to have that history in play when we do our intake, because I think we could maybe be pushing them in a direction what they might not be ready for. They might not have some of those exercises prior in order to build up into this situation where they can be in those social situations. And it might not be social anxiety. It's just a matter of what the recovery from their traumatic brain injury could be.
Absolutely. It might be more of like the sensory processing of it. So it's just, I had a patient who, at the holidays was, you know, at a party, multiple TVs were there, you know, conversations, back and forth, the lights were dim, but the TVs were bright and flashing. And he was like, I had to leave after. He lasted like 90 minutes. And he, you know, I thought that was actually a pretty good tolerance, not socially awkward, but he started to feel that angst, you know, while he was at the party. So good news is Super Bowl came now. We're a couple months down the road from recovery and that sort of thing. He was so excited. He came in. He's like, I played pool. I was able to, you know, do the visual aspects of it. Three TVs were on. I was having conversations, you know, typical party kinds of behavior. So yeah, it's very important to realize that it may not be angst from the emotional side. It's just, it's the processing of those systems on the sensory end. We really address a lot with our clients, a lot of the vagus nerve activation and just getting them out of fight or flight. So often these guys are in a huge fight or flight response. And so we try to teach them occupation-based strategies. So we work a little bit on mindfulness, but we also work on just day-to-day things that they can do. Of course, being OTs, PTs, it's a lot of, you know, we encourage proprioceptive input. So working out and doing yoga and doing inversion, you know, anything upside down will activate that vagus nerve, and we'll treat that. We'll give them different kinds of strategies that they can do when they start to feel that. And that also then relates into that interoception piece that we try to educate our clients on. Like, so if you feel that your brain is fast and that your heart is racing, and that your breathing has changed, what emotion is that? Okay. So then they can identify that that's the anxiety piece because it's too loud, because it's too bright. And then, okay, so what can you do to self-regulate? And then we'll talk about, you know, regulated breathing, or we'll talk about then remove yourself for a couple minutes and then come back. So, we really do go into that piece of self-regulating, to help with that mind body awareness, just so that they know how to calm themselves down too. And that's all a result of that concussive piece.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, even as we're going on in the show, you know, I'm hearing so much of the need for us as clinicians to really be part of this treatment as well. How do you recommend that OT and mental health collaborate together? Do you get therapists that reach out to you? Do you reach out to therapists? Like, how can we collaborate better?
We definitely need to collaborate better. I think a lot of times no one knows what OT does. Where again, you know, everyone knows what PT does. I think OT, we work with kids, you know, who have autism or that sort of thing. People pigeonhole us in that arena, or, we work in nursing homes because we help people get dressed and learn how to get back home and that sort of thing. But OT is such a vast field because we look at all of these things that influence occupation and our life roles and that sort of thing. And we're experts at breaking down activities so that we know everything that comes into play, with what you have to do to be a student, to be a worker, and all of that sort of stuff. So I think we recognize, and I hope that we recognize, you know, when people need you guys as the mental health experts and clinicians in terms of that talking, or if they need medication, or maybe this is a time where you need to, you know, go back on your medicine that you were on prior to, if there's a premorbid condition. I think, yeah, it's just an awareness of all other professions to know like what OT has to offer. And that's almost, I don't want to say a shame on us for not advocating ourselves enough, but just, getting out there and understanding what we can do to work together. Because like I said, for us, like if you guys are having people who aren't working because they just can't tolerate it, or, and you know, there's that financial burden and that sort of thing, we look at that return to work. We look at, those kiddos who had sports related concussions and aren't doing well in school. And so now the parents too don't know what to do. Like, are they supposed to do, you know, online schooling? Well, that's going to increase their symptoms because they're going to be looking on a screen all the time. Or should they be in the classroom, or is there like a hybrid version that we can kind of work on? And then we also look at that self-regulation piece. We look at those compensatory strategies like we just talked about, mm-hmm. for, you know, noise reduction and overload, and just using like blue filters on fluorescent lights in the school, and being a piece of that. And I think it's just, us knowing when we're in over our heads and we need more of your expertise, and then you guys being like, hey, I think there might be something that OT can help you with too.
Yeah, I think that's a huge piece of it. And I'm hoping that our listeners are taking that away from this show, is really vastly understanding the depth of what OT does. Because I'm totally guilty of that. My knowledge of OT was pretty limited until we had this show, until we started talking. And I feel like there's just definitely more of a need for the two to collaborate. And I think especially because it's the limited awareness we have of OT.
I agree.
Yeah. The one thing as we're talking, I think we need to hit on athletes, right? So return to play for athletes. I can suspect sometimes this can be difficult for athletes and coaches to wait until the TBI is healed. Can you explain to us how that works? Like, you know, how do you
typically
kind of
Yeah. So really what should happen is they should not be returned to play until their return to learn has been cleared. So they should be able to tolerate school for a full 8-hour day without having headaches, without having nausea, without having any cognitive issues before they return to play. But typically that's not the case. A lot of times is, oh, you don't, and I had mentioned this before, oh, you don't have a headache, you don't have symptoms in terms of that. Not the cognitive piece, but in terms of like a headache or you feel pretty good, your balance is okay. All right. Yeah. You can go back in and you can play. So, you know, there's pressure on these kids from themselves, especially if they're in high school and they're looking for scholarships and that sort of thing. There's whether it be self-induced or true peer pressure, right? All my friends will think I'm a wuss if I don't get back on the field and that they can't see that my head hurts and that sort of thing. So there's that aspect of it. You know, coaches, of course, some of them, you know, want to win at any expense. I'm not saying that that is the case 100% of the time at all, but there are those coaches that we've all seen where they just, you know, they're in it for the ribbon at the end of the day. In terms of return to sport, as I mentioned, they may be reporting symptom free, but their brain still isn't quite ready. And usually there's another half window that we're missing. And then if concussions are being shown not to necessarily be cumulative if they're fully healed. If you know you had your concussion in January and you've resolved all your symptoms and you feel like you're 99% back to baseline and then you get another concussion, it doesn't necessarily build on each other. But if you go in, you get second impact because you're not fully healed. We have people who, you know, were in a car accident and now their depth perception is off. Now they've bumped their head on their cabinet door or they had a slip and fall down the stairs because, again, you know, they were having balance issues or vision was off or they weren't paying attention. And now you've got that layering effect, then that's only going to make it longer to heal. And then a likelihood that you may not get back up to that 100%. So in terms of return to sport, it's super, super important. And not to rush the return to play and to fully understand that just because you're not symptomatic, that there's still a little bit of a time window that we should give, especially these kiddos, you know, to get back on that field.
To fully heal and recover. I remember a couple of years ago, my kids play youth sports and one of the big hospital systems in the area was offering, it's almost like they had all the kids do these screening tools to see where their baseline brain functioning was so that if they were to get an injury, they would have that baseline to see, to compare where they are after the TBI versus where they were before. Is that an effective intervention? Do we need to be doing that more? Is that a helpful at all?
It is good to do baseline testing, but like anything, there are always going to be a couple kids who think, well, if I do really bad on the test and I don't really try, when I do have a concussion and I have issues, then I'll just look normal. So there's that aspect of that. The other piece to that is that it is a neurocognitive testing, but it's only looking then at the cognitive piece. So really, if you do a full-on baseline testing, it should be a balance test. It should be a reaction time test. It should be a visual screen. It should be the neurocognitive piece. And it should just be a culmination of testing, not just the one neurocognitive test, because you're just looking at that one area. And like we've just discussed, there's so many facets that can be impacted. It's not just the thinking. And some people don't present with memory issues mm-hmm. after a concussion. It's definitely more headache related and balance, where then OTs aren't really involved a whole lot. That's definitely more PT that's helping them, you know, process through that concussion time. So I think baseline testing definitely has its place. It's very good to do that, but I think it definitely has to be more comprehensive than just the one neurocognitive test
yes.
that a lot of places offer.
Yes, but it needs to be the full gamut of it.
Yes.
In order, it could
Correct.
Be helpful,
yep.
but we have to do it properly. Do you notice a difference mm-hmm. in TBI recovery in our adolescent population versus with adults? Like, are they a little bit more restless? Are they a little bit more difficult to get treatment for? Or do you feel like they're more motivated?
I think it depends. If it's definitely sports related, yeah, they're definitely more motivated. I think there's an insight issue, as well, where sometimes the adolescents don't quite understand, one, the ramifications of what if I go back too early, but two, they don't really understand how their thinking is impacted or how their balance is impacted. Remember, too, that frontal lobes aren't fully developed until at least 25. And then again, if you have ADHD on top of that, it's closer even to 30, research is showing these days. So they just don't have that metacognition, that awareness of, you know, what's really happening to me. So not only are they developmental behind and they've never developed the skill to begin with, you know, whereas adults have the skill and they've maybe lost the skill or they lost that pathway to doing that, that they could do before. So, a lot of people think kids bounce back sooner because they can heal quicker. But you have to remember too, that developmentally they're not at that stage yet either. It's interesting of note, according to, like prevalence of TBIs, 0 to 4 is a very high age range, because of playground, slips and falls and that sort of thing, or being, you know, even in car seats and in accidents. Then there's a little bit of like a break. And then all of a sudden there's a rise again in frequency around age 15 to 24. So, what's kind of happening at that age? We're definitely more in contact sports, more, especially for boys, you know, more activities that are a little bit, you know, motocross and yes, those sorts of things, more activities
risk-taking
that teenage behavior. Kids. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's that aspect of it too.
So that kind of puts that age group kind of more at, sometimes it just puts that age group more in the spotlight with it because of where they are hormonally, developmentally, and then that risk-taking behavior kind of puts them more at risk in that sense.
Absolutely. Yep.
So as we wrap up the show, I absolutely love picking your brain. I've learned so much from the show, but where can we learn more and what kind of resources can you offer to mental health clinicians so that we can stay on top? Because like you said, it's within the past 5-10 years, we've been learning more. We've been doing more. We haven't been doing those football drills like you described where we're putting the little guy in with the big guy and having the smelling salts out. It's like we're coming a long way, but how do we keep on top of this? And what kind of resources can we put in our show notes to give clinicians?
There's definitely some great organizations out there. Lash and Associates has some good handouts in regards to TBI and how it impacts us in terms of stress and anxiety, in terms of sleep, irritability, how it impacts school, work, and relationship kinds of statuses as well. The Brain Injury Association of America has a great website, and that's where we get the certified brain injury specialist certification from. So they have a good website as well. I'm trying to think of other places that I've kind of found a lot of information. If you're interested in looking at any of the visual aspects that can happen after concussion, the College of Vision Development has some nice resources, just to kind of verify too, how vision can be impacted by concussion and that sort of thing. So those are the areas. NORA is another excellent website. It's another neuro-optometric, organization that we as OTs kind of look to in regards to treating the concussion aspect of on the rehab end. So hopefully that will be a guide to for the mental health professionals to kind of be like, oh, maybe I should, you know, develop this in my questionnaire and my intake and that sort of thing to help on understanding what we as OTs then do too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just as me and Alicia have connected. Alicia lives in the same area as me. I think it's important for other mental health clinicians to reach out to their local OT resources, even just to give a phone call, send an email, say, hey, I think it would be helpful if we collaborated. Can we meet? Can we talk? Those kinds of things. Just as me and Alicia did, I want to encourage other mental health clinicians to be doing the same so that we can better serve our patients and serve them more effectively and have that background and knowledge to pass on, to share to them, to make sure they're getting the proper care and treatment, especially if they have had a traumatic brain injury and they've been told that they are healed and they're recovered. They're 7 to 10 days. They're not sensitive to light or stimulus anymore, but they're still struggling with these other symptoms that even though somebody gave you the clean bill of health, like you can, here's a resource that I have for you. You can go to this local occupational therapist and they can help you fully recover from your TBI. So for me, I want to encourage our mental health clinicians to reach out to your local occupational therapist in your area. Do you have any last minute closing?
Sarah.
Yeah, I think this is one of the big goals of the show. What are some closing thoughts that you have?
Just to remember that it is definitely an invisible disease, disorder, however you want to quantify it as an invisible dysfunction, where just because someone looks like they're okay, or just because they are out possibly on, you know, out in public, that they are still struggling and that you don't know what happens, again, like any kind of mental health disease, you don't know what happens behind closed doors. So just because they're out and about for 5 minutes does not mean that they're not paying for it, you know, a couple minutes later, or a couple hours later. And just to understand that it really truly is a whole body process. It's not just a brain injury. It's definitely a huge psychosocial brain body connection and awareness occurrence that is happening when they have these traumatic brain injuries, and that, there is help out there to treat the whole person and to get them back to being functional. So that is the good news part of that for sure.
Yeah. So, and I think especially in mental health, we need to understand that and understand how people are feeling invalidated by others around them who think just because they're up and walking around that it's they must be healthy, they must be okay, they must be milking if they're getting disability services, sometimes people can have this negative connotation. But I think in mental health, that is something that our patients would bring up, and it's important to validate how they're feeling, what they're going through, and if, you know, to not let other people's judgment influence their care that they're giving to themselves in the recovery. Don't let other people's judgment make you rush and ignore your symptoms, but to try to understand that not everybody is educated in this field and understands TBIs, and you need to focus in on yourself and what you need to do to get back to feel 100% and not tend to other people's judgments or misconceptions of your injury. So
absolutely, 100%.
Good. So I'm going to get some of those links from that Alicia had just mentioned to us for additional information. I want to thank everybody for listening. If you want to obtain continuing education credit hours for listening, stay tuned to the end of the show to learn how. And thank you so much. And we'll see you next time on Therapeutic Perspective. Have a good day. If you listen to the podcast and you would like to obtain continuing education credit hours from NBCC, please check out our website at therapeuticperspective.com. You will first need to click on the show that you just listened to, then the Take This Course button. From there, you will complete the payment process and attest that you listened to the show in its entirety. After the payment is processed, you will take a 10-question quiz followed by an evaluation so that we can better serve you. After these steps are complete, you will be given your certificate, which can be printed or stored on your therapeuticperspective.com account. If you need any help or support in the process, please email us at therapeuticperspectivepodcast@gmail.com.